Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Niamh Mulvey, on her debut novel, The Amendments.
Niamh Mulvey is the author of the short story collection Hearts and Bones, which was shortlisted for the John McGarren Award. Her short fiction has been published in The Stinging Fly, Banshee, Southward and The Irish Times, and has been shortlisted for the Sean O'Phelan Prize. Today we're going to be talking about Niamh's debut novel, which is The Amendments. Niamh, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us then, first of all, how you would describe the novel.
Oh gosh, well, I think I would say that it is a multi-generational family saga set in a changing Ireland.
So the title, The Amendments, comes from the fact that it's the background of the story against which the plot of the various women characters in the story is set is a number of amendments to the Irish Constitution. So before we dive into any of the characters, we're going to spend some time talking about politics. So let's talk about, it starts with there's the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution in 1983 and then goes on.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what Ireland was like. And what we're talking about here is basically amendments to do with women's rights in general, but abortion in particular. So let's talk about what Ireland was like from that perspective before 1983, first of all.
Gosh. Yeah, well, I think it's probably sensible whenever talking about a time that you didn't experience directly yourself, that it's always a bit of a projection, it's an illusion, you know, and so my feeling about that time, you know, is my feeling about that time and my imagine, and it exists in my imagination, and that's what's in the book, even though I tried to ground it in reality. So I did a lot of reading and research, and also, you know, I was born in the early 80s, so I can access that time, but in a very kind of vague, sort of inchoate kind of way. And also, I talk a lot to my parents, you know, so the early 80s would have been their coming of age time, really. So even though the title makes it seem maybe more political than it is as a novel, I don't think of it as a political novel, really. And I wanted it to feel, you know, I wanted all of that to feel like the background, because that's what it is for most people. You know, it's, you know, people are living their lives. Sometimes I imagine, you know, all of us ordinary humans just trying to get by while like the big headline history is happening kind of above somewhere. And we're just trying to hide, just sort of get through the days while that happens. And I think in the book, I hope there's this sense of pushing back against the idea of there ever being one narrative about any one time or any one place in a particular time. So having said all of that, I guess we could say that the early 80s and the 70s in Ireland were a world away from where we are now. It was much, much poorer. There was very high emigration. There was the violence in the north. And women's rights were really not very spoken of, I don't think. That's my sense of that time, that there had been a bit of a kind of, I guess, a effloration of female activism in the 70s. But then there was a reaction to that, as there often is. And I think the Eighth Amendment, which was voted for by the people, it has to be said, in 1983. I guess that was kind of, that's seen as, I guess, the as almost like the accumulation of that backlash to women's rights. So just for people who don't know, the Eighth Amendment, you know, solidified the illegal nature of abortion in our constitution. It was already illegal, you know, in throughout Irish history, and it was illegal in the 80s still, but only through mere legislation. And I think there was this fear because of the women's activism I just mentioned. There was a fear that that legislation would be, you know, changed. And so it was conservative forces within the country wanted to copper fasten, I guess, the legal status of abortion. And so, yeah, that's the way things were back then.
And then in 1992, there's an Irish Supreme Court case, particularly over the case of a 13-year-old girl. Tell us something about what that case was.
So that became known as the X case. And it really, you know, it was one of these things that everyone says would never happen. So post, you know, and it's interesting to go back and look at the debates. And I found a clip of Mary Robinson, who later became president, who was a lawyer, a very precocious and intelligent young lawyer at the time in 1983, almost predicting what would happen in the X case, which is that a young girl became pregnant as a result of rape and went to her parents, and her parents brought her to England for an abortion. But they then sought legal advice as to the legality of what they were doing. And then they were told to come back home because it was said that, you know, there was this uncertainty as to whether, you know, because of the Eighth Amendment, that the state had a legal responsibility to protect the life of this girl, this 14-year-old girl's unborn child. And so the girl was brought back to Ireland and they had to pursue the matter through the courts. And obviously, you know, when you're pregnant, time is of the essence. So it was a really horrific case and it really did electrify the whole country. I'm too young really to remember it in detail, but it was kind of this, you know, this, it was almost like a landmark moment that was always referred to in later years of activism around this issue.
And then there were referendums in both 1992 and 10 years later in 2002.
Yeah.
What were they about?
So in 2002, which is kind of where the heart of my novel is set, I think, you know, without trying to go too much into the constitutional history of it, and I wouldn't be the best person to do that anyway, but post-X case, there was just a lot of legal uncertainty as to what women were allowed to do in Ireland, and whether, so there was never, you know, abortion being legal on the island of Ireland was kind of out of the question even then in the 90s. So the issues were really around the right to travel and the right to access information. And so post the X case, there was a lot of legal uncertainty. And then in 2002, there was another referendum which attempted to kind of figure out what our laws should be. And it tried to please everyone, but ended up pleasing no one. And I recall while doing the research, an American academic writing about this particular referendum. And the title of the article was something like Ambiguous Uncertainty, like the 2002 referendum in Ireland. You know, there was, because they wanted to deal with the reality that Irish women were going to have abortions and they couldn't really stop them traveling and they couldn't really stop them accessing information because that would turn us into some sort of police state. But at the same time, we didn't want this happening on our island. And again, because of that, the whole thing, the referendum was rejected because of this kind of messy uncertainty. So there was all this uncertainty for many years because I think of this reluctance to face the reality of what women sometimes need to do.
Just one more then, and we're done with the short history of abortion.
It's really testing me. I need to go back over them now before any more interviews.
So the 36th Amendment in 2018, which most people listening will remember, was successful, obviously. So what happened then?
Mm-hmm. So then it was put to the people, did they want to repeal the Eighth Amendment? And it was quite a simple question and that. And it was, you know, people knew what they were voting for, which was removing this legal obstacle that would allow for legislation for abortion to happen on the island of Ireland. So it was a very clear kind of black and white question that was put to the people, and it was and repeal was voted for. I think it was about 3-1 was how the vote went in favour of repealing. So it was a pro-choice amendment.
And so the book looks at the lives of a number of women characters, three of them in the single family, and then a fourth woman who we'll come to later. And the book jumps around in time, backwards and forwards. So what I want to do is just talk about each of these women, I guess, chronologically. So starting with, I mean, the character, I guess, that's featured the least of the four in this book, but Bridget, she seems to represent that sort of like very working class, very country woman who is implacably opposed to the very concept of women's lib, as I guess it was called then.
Yeah, so Bridget is, as you say, she's not one of the major characters. She's the mother of one of the main characters. And she would have been born, I suppose, in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And in those days, it was just, you know, most women who got married had big families. That's just, you know, the way it was. And if you talk to anyone, and that would have been my grandmother's generation. So if you talk to anyone of my age, like anyone in their 30s or 40s in Ireland, and you ask them how many siblings their parents have, it will ordinarily be sixes and sevens, even more, like eight, nines, twelves you get as well. But sixes and sevens would be pretty standard. So the mother of those sixes and sevens are who we're talking about here with Bridget. And, you know, I wasn't drawing on any one person in particular when I wrote her, but I certainly did borrow from my grandmother's lives. And my grandmother did run a pub like the one that Bridget runs in the book, and she did have that kind of life. And there was it was a very, very difficult life. It was full of work. You know, my grandmother worked almost, you know, when I was a little kid, she was you know, running a chippers. They gave up the pub and opened a chip shop, and you know, it was hard. It was hard work. But there was a lot of I don't know. I remember my grandmother and other women of that era as, you know, they were great women. They were funny and they were strong and very competent. You know, they could do, you know, you felt like they could handle anything. So I don't in any sense want to write them as poor, oppressed victims of the patriarchy, because that's not true, or it's not fully true to who they were.
You talk well in the book, I think, about the dynamics of large families. I mean, I come from a family of five myself, which is large for him.
Yeah, me,
I mean,
too. I'm the eldest of five as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not large by this sort of like historical Irish standard. No, and I was interested how you talk about the idea when, like, in a family of, like, I don't know, say 12 people, there'll be some of the kids that are basically just forgotten and, like, directionless because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I find these, you know, in fiction is a mode of work that's always kind of looking for economy. So, you know, it's not easy to write about a family with like loads and loads of siblings. And I did really struggle with that for ages. Like, I knew, because I had a sense of Dolores, who's Bridget's daughter. I knew she was the youngest of a big brood. And when I'm kind of building characters, I'll always have just a vague sense of who they are to begin with. And then I always have a sense of them in terms of their conflict with other people. So with Dolores, I was very much focused on her relationship with this Annie character, who's, we can talk about maybe later. So her family was sort of this hazy cloud to me for ages. It wasn't time to figure them out. And they came to me quite late in the day. And suddenly I could sort of picture them all and sense the dynamic between them. And, you know, I wanted to find a way, like, it would have been so much easier just to have Dolores have fewer siblings, because they don't all play a major role in the plot. But I couldn't do that because it just wouldn't have been true to her character. Like, someone like her would have come from a big family. And, you know, there's only six of them as well. So I could have pushed it more. Or is there seven? Six or seven? I'm drawing a blank for a second. Like, it's not the biggest one, but I could have pushed it. But that wouldn't have been true. And so I had to find a way to, you know, try and make the family and the siblings feel both like distinct as individuals, but also create this sense of them as some sort of unit, you know, and as a kind of entity that kind of, you know, while the individuals within it do break away, they're always sort of, you're always connected as well to the people that were in your family, to the people that you grew up with. And, you know, I think, you know, in those days, like life was just materially much, much harder. And I think, you know, if you talk to people quietly and people will tell you all these secrets, and, you know, there was often issues with like favorites, you know, when women had these huge families, often, you know, it would be very clear to siblings who the favorite was and all this kind of stuff that we wouldn't really kind of talk about nowadays. But that, you know, that's the reality. And the other thing I think that often happens in big families is like little factions. You'll have like a little cluster of three who really get on and talk to each other all the time. And then there's maybe one or two that are kind of, you know, maybe a bit more on their own within the family unit. And so there's just always a lot going on in those families, and trying to find a way to, you know, bring that energy and sense to the book without having that overwhelm the plot. That was a real challenge, actually.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Niamh Mulvey, and we're talking about her debut novel, The Amendment. And Niamh, you mentioned Dolores, who is the next character I want to talk about. So she's Bridget's daughter and the youngest of that family. But we see her in the main in the book to begin with in 1982, a time she leaves the family to get away and goes away to Secretarial College in Dublin, because they live out somewhere else outside of Dublin in the countryside. And she meets this woman that you mentioned, Annie, becomes friends with, who is clearly from a much more middle class background than she is. And yeah. And this is how she sort of begins to discover the burgeoning women's movement. But tell us something more about Dolores and this time in Dublin.
Yeah. So she, you know, she's the youngest, and, you know, she's actually gets on really well with her mother. There's this lovely bond between them. But there's very little open to her in terms of like opportunities. You know, she's, you know, it's not like nowadays where you can, there's any number of kind of third level courses that you can study for, and university is much more accessible, you know, now than it was then. So, you know, I think Dolores, I think, you know, she has this sense that there's a big world out there. She kind of wants to get to it somehow, but she doesn't quite know how. You know, there's no, you know, there's a few little grasps of kind of freedom that you can make, but there's not many. And so she works in the family business for a year or two, saves up money, and can afford then to go to Dublin and pay rent for a while and do a secretarial course. When I was playing around with this character initially, I had her just go to Dublin and work in a cafe. And I was talking to my mother about it, and I was like, she would never do that. It wouldn't, you know, it just wouldn't be, it's not, that's something that people do now because they can afford to sort of just go and have adventures for the sake of it, you know, whereas in those days, people had to be much more practical about what kind of choices that they made. So the secretarial course gives her this kind of something sensible to do and something that's going to give her some skills for the future. But really what she is really seeking is adventure. And the adventure comes to her via this Annie character who introduces her to, you know, feminist activism.
Tell us something more about this Annie then, who she is.
So the poor Annie, I kind of feel like Dolores is quite hard on her in the book. You know, I would have, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but I don't think Dolores just can't really, I think she does see Annie quite clearly ultimately. So Annie is a student, you know, she's studying law. She is the kind of person who knows a lot about the world through books, but not much through experience. Whereas Dolores is sort of the other way around. She knows a lot about the world through having worked in her family business and seen, you know, a lot of the struggles that her older siblings would have gone through and her mother has gone through. So I think there's this tension between them, between Annie, who has access to language that Dolores does not. Like Annie's very good at understanding the world in terms of concepts. Like she's got like feminist consciousness. She's even got class consciousness in a sense, like she knows that language, but she's really, really clueless about how to actually deal with people as individuals. And she ends up sort of using Dolores, actually, I think, as a bit of a prop in her own activism. Again, not intentionally, she doesn't mean to, but that's just her understanding of the world. But this proves quite unbearable, ultimately, to Dolores.
We next see Dolores in the early 2000s. 2002 is the point of that referendum that we talked about earlier. And she's the mother of a teenage girl, Nell. And Nell is, I mean, Nell's probably the main protagonist of the story, but we'll come on to Nell in a moment. Just tell us something about what's changed for Dolores at this point.
So in 2002, Dolores, you know, she's come into her fullness, I think, as a person. And she's married to Liam, who's her childhood sweetheart. And I think they actually have a really fantastic kind of, you know, partnership. They, you know, despite like challenges that they have, they really do kind of understand each other and support each other. Again, kind of because they have to. You know, I think there's a sense with those two that they're the two of them against the world. You know, neither of them have any kind of family money. Neither of them are university educated, but they do have this loyalty to one another that kind of carries them through life. And in 2002, that's probably the moment of their thriving, because Liam, who works in the building trade, he has money for the first time in his life, in his family's life. And they're kind of having a good time. You know, they don't have to worry about the bills. They can go on holidays. You know, it's, you know, life is looking pretty good for them at this moment. Except for, of course, they have a teenage daughter, and teenage daughters do tend to bring, you know, quite a lot of stress into families at certain points.
So let's talk about Nell then. So who is she when we meet her at this point? Well, at the beginning of the book, we meet her as an adult, but at this point in the early 2000s, when we first meet her as a teenager.
Well, Nell is a whole heap of contradictions, I think. And, you know, she is Dolores's daughter, and she is very much Dolores's daughter. I think they're quite similar, but Nell's a bit harsher, I think, maybe in some ways. And even though she, you know, ostensibly the times that she has been born into, like she's coming of age in the early 2000s, you know, life should be easier for her, but somehow it isn't. So I think this just partly to do with her personality, and she is observing around her. You know, I kind of was interested in the fact that Dolores, as a young woman, goes towards something that's, you know, against the spirit of her time. So, you know, so in 1983, she's attracted to, you know, feminist activism. And, you know, the Eighth Amendment is voted in, you know, very, you know, with a lot of certainty, you know, it was a very popular measure, you know. So Dolores is kind of against the spirit of her time. And then Nell, who becomes attracted to a Catholic youth movement, that's very much against the spirit of the early noughties in Ireland, which was a time of, you know, quite like sort of hedonistic enjoyment. And, you know, this is, you know, when I'm around Nell's age, like there was no sense that the Catholic Church had any say in anything. You know, it was technically still there, but no one took it seriously, certainly not young people. So Nell, in actually wanting to figure out what this institution is and why the culture kind of still pays lip service to it, you know, that's very unusual in just the way her mother was unusual a generation before her, because I think these patterns do play out. And Nell is also a lesbian, but she doesn't quite know that yet, or maybe she kind of senses it. So that is, I guess, also a bit of a complicating factor. And yeah, she's just the kind of, somebody was asking me about her the other day, and I think maybe her problem is that she wants everything to make sense. She wants the way that people behave in society to kind of line up with the rules as they're written down, and they just don't, and they never do. And that really kind of troubles her as a young person, which I think is common. I think young people really want things to make sense, and, you know, life can feel very confusing when it doesn't.
What is this movement that she becomes part of? Is this based on a real thing?
Yes, it is. Although I kind of, based on a real thing, but like with everything in fiction, it starts off real and then you start to turn it into something else to serve the story. But yeah, it was based on a movement that I had some experience with as a teenager. And much like Nell, for me, the attraction was not, although I think Nell is probably a bit more religious and spiritual than I am, but I think what's really interesting to her, it's kind of like a gateway into another world. So through this movement, she meets people from other countries, for example, which, you know, it's kind of amazing to think now of how just, you know, non-diverse Ireland was back in those days. It was just always very interesting when you met someone from somewhere else. And she's a curious, like her mother before her, she's just very curious about the world, hungry for the world, hungry for experiences with people from different places. And that is partly what this movement gives to her. But also, I don't want to shy away from the fact that it is a religious movement, and that has attractions to her too.
And this is where the fourth character that I wanted to talk about comes in. So yeah. Martina, who is our sort of mentor in this group, Nell's mm-hmm. mentor. Tell us something about who Martina is.
So Martina, in terms of her age, is kind of in between Nell and Dolores. So she would have been born in the early 70s. And Martina is a bit of a heartbreaking character. My brother, when he read the novel, he said he really, I think he said it was his favorite character, but he also said he just really felt for her because in the end, God also left her too. Because Martina is a deeply, deeply religious person, and she is part of this movement that Nell joins, and she just feels completely out of sync with the times. You know, in an earlier culture, Martina would almost certainly have joined a convent and been a nun, but she doesn't really feel, she finds that the kind of Catholicism, the mainstream Catholicism on offer in Ireland, is just kind of dying and old. And then she discovers this movement, as I write about in the book, and that feels much more alive and much more exciting to her. So she like fully commits to that.
So the book starts off with Nell in 2018 in basically present day London. Mm-hmm. The real heart of the book is telling us, you know, how Nell became the person that she is and things yeah. that happened to her through her life, which I obviously don't want to talk about because I don't want to give away. But just tell us what you can about who she is when we first meet her in the novel.
Yeah, I think the most important thing about Nell, you know, when we first meet her at the very beginning and throughout the book, is that she's just met the love of her life, you know, and this is a transformative experience, as it is for most people when they meet someone who is right for them. And I know it's really old fashioned to talk about that, but you know, it is true that, you know, when someone meets someone who is really, really right for them, it can have this really wonderfully transformative experience. And, you know, I've seen that, you know, happen, you know, to people that I know. And I think Nell is feeling she's met this person, it's the woman for her, everything is going to be okay as long as she just doesn't mess it up. And her great love is a woman called Adrienne. And Adrienne, she really, really wants to have a baby. And that means Nell has to revisit her own teenage years, because as a teenager, she became pregnant and lost the baby. That's not a spoiler. You know that from the beginning. And so she just has to go back to that experience and face it in order to fully commit to this new life that she has. And that's kind of like the struggle of the story, is her, will she or won't she be able to accept this new love in her life?
To finish it off then, can I get you to read us a bit?
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to read the first couple of pages from the novel. London, January 2018. The atmosphere in the room is deeply familiar. Nell tries not to notice what it reminds her of. Madeline, the therapist, a well-preserved 45 or so, looks at them both with an expression of contained but intense curiosity, rather like a cat before it pounces. Her nails are pink but pointed, her thin hair neatly combed but a little crackly at the edges, as if alive with static. They have been talking for a while, or Adrienne has been talking for a while. She sketches out the basics of their predicament. She puts words on the situation. It amazes Nell to hear her do that. Part of the reason to be in love with someone was to have them explain you, she reckons. She didn't know that before Adrienne. Mothering, Madeline says. She says it a little grandly, a little luxuriously. You were both going to be mothers to this child. You both have different experiences of being mothers. And you, Nell, have been a mother. Madeline turns her attention to Nell. Her eyes are certain and blue. Nell feels irritated. It's one thing for Adrienne to sum up her life. It's quite another for a stranger to do so. She looks away. She feels Madeline's eyes on her cheek. But looking away brings her face to face with Adrienne, who is more terrifying than Madeline is irritating. So she turns back again. I never thought of myself as a mother, Nell says. She hears herself speak tersely. She feels bad about it. But these things are being pulled out of her, and it hurts. It's what you were, Madeline says. You carried a child in your body. It's textbook. Yes, Nell says, but I never looked after it, so it doesn't feel right to use that word. What she wants to say is, she didn't want to use that word then, now, or ever. That's the unsayable truth here, the thing that makes a mockery of this entire process. If Adrienne finds out the full extent of Nell's not wanting, then she will leave her. And Nell has no doubt that Adrienne will do that, because Adrienne is the kind of person who always ultimately does the right thing. Madeline smiles, her attention now straight ahead, her chin slightly tilted up. She has a professorial, somewhat dramatic air, as if overcome by the grand complexity of human affairs, but prepared, all the same, to keep on keeping on. Her voice is deeper than one would think just looking at her. The authority her voice imparts heightened somehow by this unexpectedness. Nell imagines that Madeline enjoys the disorientating effect this must have on people. She also wonders what it must be like to be so sure about things. I appreciate that, Nell, Madeline says. It's the looking after that counts in mothering. It's about the relationship. Perhaps I won't use that word to refer to you during that time. Nell shrugs. She doesn't care what this woman calls her. She feels herself being managed. She resents it, but only a little. What's important is that Adrienne is smiling in her fierce way. What's important is that Adrienne feels like this is working.
So I've been talking to Niamh Mulvey. We've been talking about her debut novel, The Amendments, which is out now in the UK from Picador. Niamh, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you so much, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.